Hey there, my name's Mark McCartney and welcome to the What is a Good Life podcast. Over the last 3 years, I've interviewed over 200 people around this question, not to prescribe you with the universal answer, but to help you to find and define your own answer to this question. I'm hoping the guests' explorations, inquiries and curiosities prompt your own lines of inquiry into this question. While I'm also trying to share with you what I perceive to be more genuine expressions of the human experience and indeed more meaningful conversations. Which brings us to this week and the 64th episode of the What is a Good Life podcast, and I'm delighted to introduce Johnny Moore as our guest. Johnny is the founder of Unhurried, a movement to support deeper conversations and connections at work and in life, the author of the book Unhurried at Work, a visiting tutor at the Said School of Business at Oxford University, and a guest columnist for Fast Company magazine. In this highly insightful conversation, we explore our desire to hold on to stories and perspectives that no longer serve us over engaging with the unknown. Johnny shares a number of experiences and processes that help him see and seek more possibilities. We discuss shifting from overthinking to experimenting and playing more often. And finally, we explore realizations around awareness of emotions and healthier, more connecting expressions of them. This episode will give you plenty to contemplate in terms of playing and experimenting more frequently, and the wonderful shifts that can occur if we open up to what else is possible in this life. I've spoken with Johnny several times before, and he consistently leaves me with new perspectives to consider or inspires fresh realizations. And in this episode, I suspect he'll do the same for you too. And if you enjoy this conversation, please like, share, and subscribe. And if you're on the podcasting platforms, please continue to leave your lovely reviews as it greatly helps me at this stage of my podcasting journey. And if you'd like to hear more of my reflections on these conversations, you can check out my weekly What is a Good Life newsletter on Substack at www.whatisagood.life. And please check out the notes below if you want to find Johnny's book or some of his other work, and indeed ways of contacting me regarding individual coaching and executive group coaching. So having said all that, without further ado, the 64th episode of the What is a Good Life podcast. Johnny, thank you very much for joining me on the What is a Good Life podcast today. Having had many conversations with you before, I've been really looking forward to recording this one and seeing where the hell it goes.
I feel the same way, Mark.
Wonderful. Well, Johnny, as I kick these conversations off with, it is with the question of, is there a question you're trying to answer as you move through life?
It's funny, Mark, because when I watched previous episodes of this, I realized, I thought to myself, oh, I haven't got an answer to that question. And then I forgot all about it. But now that you've asked it, I've gone, funnily enough, I've decided my question at the moment is, what else is possible here? As a kind of theme, I even changed my LinkedIn profile at the weekend to what is possible here as a kind of experiment in presenting to myself to the world that way. Because I think I realize that I, and I suspect other human beings, fall into ruts constantly without ever noticing that we're in a rut. And as a result of wearing these kinds of blinkers, mixing my metaphors a bit, I think we restrict our choices. So to pause and ask ourselves in any situation, especially ones that are a bit stressful or difficult, what else is possible here? Seems like a good starting point.
You know, it's funny you say that. I was in dialogue or in conversation with a friend last week who was facing a bit of a dilemma. And I was very much categorizing the whole thing as it's either A or B, right? But there's something very liberating or freeing about just the reflection then of just going, is there another way here? Is there something we're not considering, or what else could that be?
And when you think about it, that must always be true. I mean, we do know that our mind is a fantastic editor of reality, and that we're constantly filtering our experience unbeknownst to ourselves. There are vast quantities of colours that we don't see because our brain is editing those images out. And so it's always got to be, there's always got to be other choices available to us, so sometimes subtle ones. And I think my life is most exciting when those moments happen where you suddenly realise, oh, it may not be what I thought it was. It may be something else. I mean, for instance, I got an email a couple of days ago from someone about a proposal I'd put to them. And I read the email and I thought, oh, they're asking me to halve my price. And I'll look at it tomorrow. I don't want to think about it now. I could feel the disturbance to my system, and some other part of my brain went, well, just forget about it. It's probably better not to overreact. But it's but whispered that they're trying to cut your price in half. How dare they? And I was starting to, inadvertently, bits of my mind were rehearsing all sorts of sort of pointless reactions to this. But I managed to put it out of my mind, and then I reread the email the next day, and I realized it wasn't really saying, give me half price. He was just saying, can you do something with the price? I normally pay 50% of this, which is a completely different email to the one that I'd read the night before.
You know, it really makes me think of, if we don't have some sort of space in our lives, just how many things we're misreading all the time. Because I've had a really similar experience where I got feedback on something recently where, a bit like yourself, I took a quick glance at it and I was almost like, oh God, I can't face that right now. and then when I looked at it, it's very, very same thing. When I looked at it the next morning, I was like, oh wow, this is just positive and constructive. Like, do you know what I mean? There was no edge to it whatsoever.
I mean, I've been thinking so much about how we're, it's as if we're constantly making stories up in our heads and we just don't catch ourselves doing it. And I think if when I did a lot of therapy work 30 years ago in groups, you'd watch people having an argument and suddenly it became obvious that somebody might say in that argument, well, I don't necessarily agree with that. And the other person will then mimic them back. What do you mean you don't necessarily agree with that? And it's like they completely over-dramatized it. And yet somehow between the statement and their mind, it all got completely distorted. And then, of course, in response to this bit of sarcasm or exaggeration, the other person goes, blah, blah, blah. And you can see how conflict arises. And it's just this sort of bouncing. It's almost like, I don't know, it's like some cascading hall of mirrors of our reactions to each other. And when you think about it, it's amazing that we get along at all as human beings, given this extraordinary capacity we have to imagine things that aren't really there.
Yeah, it really is. Like, I sometimes look at the world and you know, once again, it can be depending on how I'm perceiving it, but it is like almost miraculous that we're all still here with just the capacity that we have to just overblow these things. And you know, there's a thought that I've been having recently, which is, it's never ever personal, even if the person has like suggested that there are things that they personally disagree about me, like that they find offensive or non-agreeable about me, because it's very likely that this opinion of theirs has been formed right on the spot, irrespective of everything else they've gone through their life. It's far more likely that they don't like me. Look, you know, of course we can just have preferences, but all it is a preference, essentially. Like, it's not something personal towards us. And yet, at the same time too, if somebody says something deeply personal to me, I'm going to take it very personally.
I'm smiling because, you know, I wish I could count the number of times I've been told by people very wisely not to take things personally. And it's often a very unhelpful thing to say to someone under stress. It's very difficult. And, you know, I read a book the other day. I think it was called, it's No Self, No Problem. And it's quite a short little book about sort of the overlap between Buddhist thought and brain science. And it's one of a number of things that attribute a lot of our problems to our over-identification with the self that may not be there in quite the form that we think it is. And the latest reading, I notice I've got a little bit better and not getting quite so provoked by political commentators that I don't agree with. You know, I'm slightly able to attenuate wanting to say to them that they're liars or frauds and go, no, I think they've just got a story that they're very attached to. They are trapped in story the same way that I often am.
Well, you know, the moment you said that, it made me think of just how how attached I am to that description of politicians. do you know what I mean? So even I could be reading something about what somebody has said, and I'm obviously, well, it's because you don't care about the public and you don't listen to the people.
It's so easy to go there and really believe that it's true. And I think, I suppose what I think I've got better at, only relatively recently, is just sort of noticing what happens in my body when I get vehement like that. That there's a kind of constricting that happens. It's almost like my body knows that I'm kind of tightening my grip, and sort of tightening myself and restricting my experience, simplifying it, you know. And it's like, you know, one way of thinking about it is our desperation for certainty means that we'll cling to an unpleasant certainty somehow, as if we prefer that to not knowing.
You know, there's he was a comic book writer, and now he's also an author. This guy, Alan Moore, he wrote V for Vendetta and a few different things like this. And he was asked to do this kind of deep dive into create a comic based on all his research on declassified CIA documents and all of this sort of stuff. And he basically came to the conclusion that, yes, there are a great many conspiracies in the world, and off the back of that, there are also many conspiracy theories. But he said, there's no group of people controlling the world. He said, these various conspiracies exist. He goes, the reality is that they're all tripping each other up, and that the world, that nobody is in control, and the world is absolutely rudderless. And he said, that idea is far more confronting to accept than that there are a group of malevolent people that are absolutely in lockstep and in control. And I find that really interesting, like almost the idea that an evil presence or a malevolent presence is almost more comforting than absolutely no control. Like that I think is really, that's a fascinating one for me.
It's I read a book recently called Fluke by a guy called Brian Klass, which is a beautifully written book evoking a world that sounds very similar to Alan Moore's description. And it made me laugh. This was a very funny book. It makes me laugh a lot. And I think the effect on me has actually been rather nice, because I think actually I would say that if you can actually accept that the world is not something that anyone can control, but that we're all influencing, I think if you can make that imaginatively, I find that, oh, well, some of the things I get very stressed about don't matter quite so much. That there's a price to pay for that, the conspiracy theory cause-effect simplified model of the world that we get ourselves attached to. And I suppose why I thought the question, what else is possible, is me starting to exercise a preference. And no, actually, it's not so terrifying to think of the world as being, in his rather fancy technical term, contingent, highly sensitive to everything that we do. Because I can think that, and I don't find that my body dissolves. I don't have the experience of the ground swallowing me up and of all life coming to an end. I'm gonna throw in one more thought, because another book I read recently by a guy called Will Storr has the most brilliant opening of a non-fiction book that I think I've ever read, and I can't do it full justice, and I haven't got it readily to hand. But the gist of it is something like, his opening paragraph is something like, "We know how this ends. All life, all our lives will end. Everyone we'll love will die, and ultimately, heat death will end the universe as we know it." But in the meantime, to avoid having to think about that, we can make up stories. And you know, and it's like there's a kind of a sort of threshold of absurdity where if you don't take it too seriously, you suddenly find actually, is it what Alan Watts meant by cosmic joke? That there is a way of experiencing this more playfully. And that doesn't mean that everything in life suddenly becomes bliss and laughter. Because what goes with that is, I think you have to accept periods of sadness and despair and melancholy and all the so-called negative emotions as well. But then but then not feel quite like you're personally responsible for the outcome of everything.
Yeah, I think just with the opening of that book, though, I think there can also be a lightness in acknowledging that that I am making up stories. Like I seem to be this this entity that's led by imagination. Like that's how, you know, even with the idea of what else is possible, or even this that kind of evoking the idea of connecting with uncertainty and that lending into there being more possible. I think that there's some dance between uncertainty and possibility. And then I think there's also something about engaging in those two things, which then also makes the rigidness of perhaps how we're viewing life right now, which always causes suffering, right? Because if we've got a fixed view of something that's always moving and pulsing and is somewhat unfolding, we're always going to come up against the kind of the edge of our rigidness, and we're going to feel that pinch, I think.
Yeah. It's what I sometimes find myself thinking about. And I often say to people at 3 a.m, because that's often when this happens, I wake up in a bit of a what you might call a nervous state, and then I have to find a way to kind of talk to myself in the hope that I might eventually get back to sleep. It's like that's sort of, how can I put this? It's like that point where I realize there must be some interface between my imagination and my thoughts and actions and what we think of as the physical world. There must be some point at which those two are joined together, some kind of liminal space where I'm probably not putting this very well, but it's, you know, it's very easy to go off in flights of fantasy and imagination, positive or negative, in the way that we've been discussing. But there must be a connection somewhere between this thinking stuff that my brain is doing and then the stuff that's unfolding in the world. There must be, I assume there's some interface somewhere between the two. And I was thinking about that last night, and I think I've woken up and been anxious, and then from somewhere I got this sort of, well, if I don't, it was something like, instead of thinking, I just wiggle in bed and move my body, and that allow the movement of my body to be how I think. Which I found quite comforting. I thought, well, this is odd. Why am I doing this? It's almost like, oh, it's almost as if a puppeteer is moving my body for me, but that might be me doing it. And I think it was just me playing with, oh, it sounds very pretentious, but like kind of playing with, what is this? What is this experience I have? I sometimes find when I'm swimming, I take a pause between lengths and I sit in the pool, and that's the point at which I find myself thinking, what exactly is this? This life, what is this experience I'm having? Who is this having this experience? What is this? What is this life?
I've even had the same experience playing with my movement and wondering what's directing it. Because it's really interesting, because whether it's a definitive thought that I think that is leading that, or whether I'm doing it, whether even if it's just myself and I feel like I'm being performative, even just in the isolation of my own company, the fact is I'm still doing it. You know, like, yeah. I'm still wriggling as some form of expression or curiosity or exploration or play, or just, it's just happening. And it's... Yeah. And I love that. Like, I love those moments in whatever it may be of just taking stock, like, and just looking around and going, what is this life? Like, what? Like, I do it. Sometimes I do it with my dog, and I'm just kind of just taking it all in. And I'm just like, okay, like, there's things that I maybe really enjoy. It's irrespective of whether it's a moment where I'm feeling just extreme joy or gratitude or even tension. That experience of just kind of taking stock and life almost seeming like a bit of a movie set, like, and that I'm just observing it all play out. It's a really curious one.
It's something that I started to realize a lot happening when I do these unhurried conversations, which are essentially talking stick conversations where we just have this protocol for one person talking at a time. And I've been running them for quite a long time now. And it dawned on me that there's something very satisfying for people to gather around where there's no set agenda, take turns in talking, not interrupt each other. And you get this sense after a while of, oh, so we're all just, all of us are trying to make sense of this life. When we're not trying to prove anything to each other or get anywhere in particular, we end up talking about, well, what is our, you know, because I sometimes say there's no theme or the theme is whatever is on your mind. And when people share what's on their mind, we go, oh, you start to realize, oh, so I'm not the only person who stops at the end of the swimming pool or somewhere and wonders about this or moves their body involuntarily at night. And we're all, and there's something rather lovely about getting into a space of, oh, so we're all trying to piece together what all this stuff means. Because in our daily lives, certainly in the West anyway, the default culture is not one of bemused puzzlement. It's of alternative, rather brashly offered certainties. 3 for 2, 60% off. Brexit, not Brexit, you know. This is how politics works. This is how the tax system should work. A whole series of brittle certainties bashed around. And you might think, oh, well, that's all there is. But if we just stop to pause for a moment, I suspect many more of us than you might think are having these more interesting, you could call them philosophical sort of inquiries, or we have the potential for it.
Just when you mention that and then the word potential, just going back even to your kind of an initial inquiry of what else is possible, what has led up to that being a question at this present moment in time? Like were there certain events or experiences which has brought that to the forefront of your mind?
Well, the guy who wrote the book Flute would say, well, where do we begin with the Big Bang?
I was more hoping the garden.
Because everything is massively contingent. But if you'd like a more conventional, so what are the key things? I suppose one thing that's contributed to it, I kind of invented a process with some friends of mine who are into improv theatre. Oh, 10 or 15 years ago is when we first sort of stumbled it together. And I now call it Groundhog as a process for reasons people will probably intuit fairly quickly if they know the movie. And it kind of arose when we were running a workshop and someone was talking about a difficult person in their life and how they responded to them. And I think they must have mentioned a really outrageous thing that person said to them, how they might respond. And I, on a whim, I said, why don't we play a kind of improv game, drawing on some improv forms that I'd seen, where we'll get someone to play the difficult person, we'll get them to say to you whatever it was, something, some sarcastic, rude, outrageous remark for which you feel like you've got no sensible answer. And then we'll just generate 50 different ways of responding as a group. Everyone will step in and play 50 different mad ways of responding to a provocation. I mean, to make it concrete, the provocation might, for example, have been something like, well, I don't think you should run that PowerPoint that way. You know, something said with an edge where you don't quite know how to respond. And we literally got the group to role play 50 different responses without doing much analysis. And that's the essence of what I now call Groundhog. Take a difficult provocation from your life, past or present. Try lots of different ways of responding. Don't get very attached to getting it right. Have some fun. Sing to the person. Shout at them. Wave your arms. Talk to them in gibberish. Speak to them in Spanish, try anything. And you laugh through those iterations and you sometimes think, well, what's the point of this then? And then somebody will try something and everyone goes, oh, what was that? Something you did there that worked. And you start to uncover that there are other ways of responding to provocation, which, I mean, classically end up not escalating the conflict, not giving in, but kind of meeting them in a much more exciting way. And I like that little exercise. I've done it a lot. I do it a lot with people. I sometimes do it when I'm coaching people. I sort of say, let's just generate 30 different ways. Let's not worry about getting it right. Let's just see what else is possible here. I probably even found those words coming out of my mouth. And that's probably where that question comes from. It's instead of trying to solve the problem, just say, well, what are some other ways we could do this? Because kids are very good at this. They just try any old way to, you know, when they don't understand the thing, they don't sit there and do deep philosophical inquiry. They just throw mud at the wall. They try anything. And, you know, I remember a relative of mine, 20 years ago, she would sometimes play this video game Zelda with her son. And her son was, I guess, I don't know, 5 or 6. And she said, it's very funny because when I'm presented with a problem in Zelda, I try to work it out. But Gabriel just tries absolutely anything. He tries crazy things. And you know what? He gets there faster than me because he just iterates until he finds the answer. And while I'm trying to work it out, I get nowhere because I'm too busy thinking to work it out. So that's the spirit of, that's I think how I came to that question. I probably was just saying it to people without even thinking about it. And then it's kind of lodged in my mind a lot more recently as a, you know, at least for the next few weeks anyway. Well, that's an interesting way to approach things. What else is possible here?
You know, I've never actually even thought about it. In just the example that you presented there in terms of the child and iterating things that way, like how we often are stuck almost in this pre-experiment phase where we try to do all our experimenting in theory and we try to play out all these theories, but theory isn't the reality of the situation. So in that case, like in life, I don't know, there's something about us and at some point then obviously we just stop experimenting fully. Like we try to be careful, we try to mitigate, we try to, I don't know, reduce as much as possible the chance for maybe failure, because we take it personally. Whereas a child, or perhaps even an adult then who's less self-conscious than the typical, let's say, once again, Western adult, they just want to move on. They just want to find the solution by experiencing running a number of experiments and seeing what the hell happens. And yet we somehow glorify this thinking as if it's, this makes me a smarter human being, or this makes me more efficient. But as you're alluding to there, it doesn't.
In a huge number of contexts, the whole education system is, you know, and I think my survival mechanism was to try to be clever. That was the card I thought I could play under pressure when I've been bullied at. I could try clever things. Didn't always work out very well, to be honest. And I think it's, look, obviously, there are some contexts in which it would be better to apply a great deal of careful forethought before trying something.
Of course, yeah.
Like landing an aeroplane, I wouldn't want that done by someone just experimenting. I'd quite like them to do some studies. But in so many things in life,
that's your preference, Johnny.
I catch myself constantly. Yes, I know. Call me a conservative. But there are so many things where I realize I just overthink, and that there's so much more to be learned by it. I mean, just as a very workaday example, I'm in the habit of making these little videos that I stick on LinkedIn and Substack from time to time, and they're quite a fun process. But, you know, often when I'm going to make them, I find myself, my body's going like this. Well, I could wait. And the dialogue in my head is something like, if it were a dialogue, it would be something like, well, I don't know if that's good enough. Should I do that? Oh, I don't know. And eventually I get to the point where the discomfort is so great that I pull out the phone and go, I'm going to make a really bad draft. I'm not even going to stick the phone on the gimbal. I'll just hold it up in front of me and do a really bad draft. And sometimes a bad draft is, so I'm talking to the camera, I've got this idea to talk about predestination, but I don't really know what I'm going to say, and I'm bored now. But that gets that unblocks the drain.
Right.
And then I do a second one that's a bit better. And if I just start making the stupid video, actually quite quickly, the first thing that happens is I discover some energy. Oh, I'm letting some energy flow. And then sometimes the drafts are quite good quite soon, and sometimes they're not. But at least the iteration is like I'm blocking a drain, you know, and sometimes just gunk comes out to begin with. But you go, what a relief, because the pressure's been released in the system. And after the gunk comes out, you know, some water can flow. And I think I'm kind of reliving this. Perhaps it's what I was talking about earlier, that space between, you know, language is a bit limiting here, isn't it? But between, you call it imagination or analysis or rumination, and an experiment in the world, an active experiment, we move into the world in some way. And all the fun and joy of life, I think, is, or maybe not all of it, but a lot of it is in moving from theory to practice, if you like.
Yeah, I'm really curious as to at what point did we suddenly say that we had to have all the answers? And this isn't the question, by the way, because even if I look, you know, we both mentioned kind of throwaway statements towards politics. But like, I think even in that scenario, if a leader could just simply say, this is our best guess, and that could be the reality of the situation. This is our best guess as to what will work out. If it doesn't work out, we may double back on this and then go a different path. Whereas it seems to be in our general way of looking at things that if a leader has to say what they believe in, they go forth and they just ruthlessly stick to that plan, irrespective as to how bad it's going, because that would save more face than actually saying, I tried this, it didn't work, and now I have to go back. Like, that's quite a perverse way of kind of approaching life. And even as we as a public might put that pressure or that kind of onus on somebody to deliver. Because I think we've all seen examples of that in life where we've just stuck to something because at one point, even whether it's a relationship, whatever it might be, we said we were going to do something and now we're sticking to it. And I don't know, I find it really interesting, like, at what point did it become a weakness almost for us to say, this isn't working, let's try something else?
Yeah. Maybe what's truer than that is perhaps we all move on a spectrum of obsessive, addictive, controlling, you know, at one end of the spectrum, to playful, spontaneous, nurturing, you know, at the other. And, you know, context can trigger us. You know, I think somebody who's an obsessive authoritarian at work probably melts when they meet their grandchild and start jumping in puddles together. Or at least I hope they might do. And that we have a full range of motion, and that we can respond to all of those things. I feel slightly tearful saying it, because it feels like a more optimistic way of thinking about it. That, you know, maybe we shouldn't worry too much about why people do this. I think those sorts of questions often get us stuck in not very helpful ruminations about the terrible state of the world. Whereas actually, at any point, some little tweak in the system might change the way things work. And that, you know, I think a lot of psychology is quite attached to people being a certain kind of personality. You know, an LGBX, a BIYDO, a red, a green, you know, an innovator, a this, a that, and the other. But those things are just sort of averages of a whole series of bits of behavior that might change in response to a tweak to the stimulus. I'm rambling now.
No, I think that's something that I find quite confusing sometimes. Sometimes I think when we think we get, like, we know something about somebody, to call somebody like a Gen X or a Gen Z or something like that. But, you know, it's almost kind of funny to, like, if I was using that in general parlance, assuming that I actually know somebody about the person that may be in front of me, because they may be from a certain, like, I may attribute that label to them, where it's just, once again, like, there's just so much more uncertainty or unknown about the person in front of me, far beyond what I may know about their age right now, or what average assumptions I could attribute to them.
Yeah, you know what I think of? I think of back to the days when I was doing a lot of group work. I did this training where we'd have a check-in process. It was like a five-part check-in process that we do every time we met. For maybe, you know, maybe for the first hour, it would just be this check-in where people would share under the five headings. I mean, not madly attached to this protocol, but the headings were quite interesting. There was something like, you start with appreciations, partly because that put people in a better mood. New information, puzzles, complaints and recommendations, hopes, wishes, and dreams. And sometimes in that new information thing, someone would just say, for example, oh, I've got a migraine at the moment. And it would go, and it would be like, oh, that explains why you're sitting there frowning like you are. I thought it might have been because of something I said to you in the kitchen 5 minutes ago. Is that when we get a little bit more information, it's like in that kid's kaleidoscope, the way I remember it, and I haven't used one for a while, you turn it, and then the crystals would suddenly go psh, and rearrange themselves into another pattern, give another twist, and they go psh, and they become another pattern. And that this patterning thing is going on all the time.
When you've mentioned before, just even like once again, if we think about uncertainty or possibility, what's made you more curious in recent years, even about the liminal space or even the engaging with uncertainty? Because even there, like, you know, it's like something is being revealed or there's a layer of something, more information could completely turn the world as you see it right now on its head in terms of what you were assuming about a situation.
I feel like, say, maybe it's just practice.
Right.
I think it might be I've just lived long enough that I've started to admit to myself that these obsessive patterns that I'm used to, maybe they don't work. You know, I've clung to my, you know, obsessive behaviors for a long, long time as if they're true. And, you know, maybe you just have to suffer long enough to eventually decide, oh, do you know, this is just really exhausting, getting this angry about things. So living long enough, I think in my case, having quite a lot of oblique solitude, just the way that my life has unfolded, I spend a lot of time on my own. So I've eventually got slightly better at keeping myself better company, I think. And then, you know, there are some seminal experiences that are part of it as well. So I got very interested in improv theatre. So an enormous amount of this would make a lot of sense to improvisers. They're very, you know, they're very interested in the idea of creating things in the moment, creating things in liminal space. So that's been a big influence. I kind of discovered all of that 20, 30 years ago. And then the group therapy stuff I did 20, 30 years ago, what was so powerful about that kind of, they called it encounter work. It was really extraordinary to be in a group of people where people kind of let it all hang out. You actually got the background story to people's behavior. You found out much more about people. People were sharing their very difficult, challenging experiences of life in a way that wasn't happening, you know, in the ad agencies I used to work in, where things were all quite superficial, or even at uni, where things were relatively superficial compared to that. So I think it's a grab bag of these influences that have slowly made me realize the world is a bit more potentially playful than my conventional thinking would have me believe.
What was it about the, like, even if you were, even from that contrasting of experience, like, let's say the superficial encounters maybe you were perceiving in the ad agencies, but then when you were confronted in these group therapies but when you were had access then to people's full stories, what was it about that sense of like getting the context and further sense of the person? What did that feel like initially when you started to encounter that?
Interestingly, for both improv and therapy, there are very specific incidents that leap to mind when you ask me that question, and they're not necessarily the answer, but they're the response. I remember one of the people running the therapy group saying something like, in the middle of some fierce confrontation, she said, with a very kind of placid face, she said, I like anger. It can be very energizing. And I sat there and I went, what? What did she say? What? And I think it's the response that my whole body has of not rejecting, but like, oh, wait a minute, there's something in that. I don't understand that, but that's not what I thought. And that's, what's that? That then something in this for me. You know, and as I tell you it, I realize, well, I suppose my programming was, like a lot of people, anger is very dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, and like a load of people, I was labeled the bad tempered kid in my family. So there's all sorts of gunk around anger for me, and I think for a lot of us. So the idea it could be energizing was a real aha moment. And I think it's an accumulation of these moments where you're going along in your rut and you suddenly realize you're wrong.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, funny incident. I remember when I worked with someone, this is a long time ago. We worked in advertising. We'd go out, get drunk most evenings. And morning after one of these evenings out, someone said to me, oh, good news about your friend getting married. And I said, he's not getting married. No, he's not getting married. We got that wrong. And for 3 or 4 days, I thought, this man's an idiot. And then eventually I was finally allowed to realize that actually at one of these drunken evenings, he had announced his engagement and everyone had celebrated and completely passed me by.
Wow.
You know, and it's just one of those moments where you go, oh, I can be completely convinced of something with absolute certainty and be utterly, utterly wrong. And then laugh, really, isn't that? Because isn't that great?
You know, it's just when you were mentioning the part on anger, I think that's that is a fascinating theme or topic that, because I definitely considered myself as bad tempered growing up, and just the loadedness of the word anger. And I think that there's kind of an interesting insight in that, of just to once again to realize how we may not be seeing the whole truth to something if we've got such an aversion to something. Because I too then, like yourself, would have like almost for a few years then would have almost this avert, like any sign of anger was just, there could be no other nuance to a term like anger. Other than it's bad, which, you know, which leads to its own complications, never finding a healthy expression or engagement with it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's also, I mean, the thing with these emotions is they're also, we use them in such a sort of clumsy way, I think.
Yeah.
So we say anger and we all think we know what that is. but you know, some of the research on this, which I can just about half understand, says it's actually so much more rich and complex than that. And when one person reports anger, they may well be experiencing something very different from what we might be when we're thinking of anger, you know. And that some of the best advice coming out of that research is to develop a much richer vocabulary for emotion, to become more sensitive to, I guess I would say, the kind of aliveness of it. But, you know, for a long time, I think we operated it as if anger bad, sadness definitely bad. Whereas sadness is one of my favorite emotions. It always comes as a relief when I feel sad. I mean, it's almost predictable now that I'll do this at some point in a good conversation like this one and say, oh, I'm feeling tearful. And it's not at all a bad thing. It's like a sign of aliveness. And that, you know, we live in such this sort of categorical world of good, bad emotions, this, that emotion, I'm feeling this, or you mustn't feel that. And it's like, yeah, what else is possible here? What is the gradation? What sort of anger is this? How can we describe this? Because as soon as you change the description of it, the experience changes.
You know, this is I was trying to write something about this, like even just as a note to maybe embracing anger a little bit, in the sense of, you know, sometimes we'd say, like, if you wouldn't want somebody saying that something that they just told you that they found it absolutely hilarious and proceeded to tell you in a very level way why they found it funny. Or you wouldn't want somebody who's just lost somebody and they feel a catastrophic loss in their life tell you without a tear about how sad they feel. There is something about, I don't know, just when you said the word aliveness there, I think that lens of viewing our emotions, not even lens, but just when I hear aliveness, I think of actually getting in touch with the feeling of what is being expressed or what is being felt right now. And I think that's that almost happens, while I'm using the term aliveness, that almost happens in the being the present with it. Like, you know, the way you just say, even with your sadness, like wow, before people might even think that's a negative thing. But if I'm actually in contact with my sadness right now and I can feel it right now, it's more about feeling a sense of aliveness than a categorization of the experience.
I think it's what you're saying for me connects to something else that I think I've got a handle on, again, relatively recently. About there is something about the way that we contain or hold our emotions that has a very big impact on how they operate socially. And that a pattern that I've started to notice in others, and then of course laugh because of course I'm seeing it in myself as well, is how we contain and hold our emotions. I saw something happen in a meeting a few months ago where one person in the meeting was talking to another, and person A was expressing their very strong fears, their anxieties and annoyance with person B about something that they were doing. And person B was sort of defending themselves. And what I observed metaphorically was something like this. This wasn't what was actually happening. Metaphorically, as if A was going like this and B was that. So A was fierce, blah, 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 and B was like that. And I don't think they realized what a weird dance that was, and that it wasn't really, on the surface, this was a series of arguments about did you or didn't you and have you done this, and you know, apparently about logical, rational things. But on another level, it was one person chasing the other. And I realized that what this person needed to do was sort of was become more still and present, and this person needed to sort of contain themselves a bit. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, it's like this person is trying to pass the anxiety parcel. They think they're being very clear about what they want and decisive, but on another they're saying, here, I'm feeling really anxious about what you're doing. You have my anxiety. And person B was in effect saying, well, I don't want that.
Yeah.
And I think I've often allowed my emotions to so, you know, I think it's a classic thing of repress them, and then go boom all over the place. And people have in the past have sometimes been a bit astonished by someone they thought of as very solid being very emotional suddenly. And there was like on off, but no sort of amplitude on it. And I think what you said evokes is, so when you or I do this and say how we're feeling, I think we're now doing it in a relatively contained way that isn't so terrifying to people.
Yeah.
And then we don't have to quickly, anxiously try and get rid of that feeling or quickly pass the anxiety parcel like in Pass the Parcel. We can actually be more present. So we become more present by the way we're holding the emotion, and then we're making it easier for other people to be present to us.
That's beautifully put. And I think if you were to use the experience then of anger, though, specifically, I guess it would be that if you continue not to engage with it as it ripples, like, or just causes slight movements, it eventually just gets repressed till it becomes something uncontrollable and potentially pretty nasty. And so I think it's just these continuous kind of touch points of like, this is what I'm feeling. And even just an acknowledging of that. Because I love the idea sometimes that, I don't know, that some of our emotions almost want our attention for expression. And the longer we ignore them, the more impossible they become for us to ever express or to ever express in a healthy way. So even just these like little nods or look in their directions or a little bringing to the surface of, I think it's pretty invaluable. There was something you said earlier, though, just even around your experience of, you know, well, you just mentioned even there, getting more comfortable even with sadness or a regular expression of that. But also you mentioned your experience with loneliness and also finding ways of experiencing that in different ways from where you previously had. How would you kind of categorize that comfort in solitude, shall we say?
I can't answer your question. I can just say, I just respond with what comes to mind is, first of all, like a lot of things I've said, I've noticed it's only, again, I think it's only relatively recently that I've got more of a handle on that that difference is if I can exercise some choice about it, because I think I was just lonely for large parts of my life. And thinking, you know, in terms of ruts, thinking some version of, I need someone else.
Right.
I need someone to pay attention to me, to give me what I need, you know, and have spend quite a lot of my life in what a therapist once described to me as this state of total longing. And some switch has got thrown, or at least thrown more often recently, where I've started to question whether I really need someone else to feel comfort. You know, again, I'm putting it in slightly clumsy language. It's like, well, maybe I need to find a resource within myself, as it were, for meeting troubled emotions, you know, and that somewhere in there, there's alchemy where loneliness becomes more like solitude, you know, and I'll sometimes think, well, what if I don't want somebody else? What if somebody else isn't the solution to this? Again, it's a 3 a.m. thing, because the good thing about being awake at 3 a.m. is it's very hard to get anybody to listen to you at 3 a.m. when you're upset. You know, I had a friend in Australia who for a while was very good at listening to me at 3 a.m. because it was in the afternoon and he wasn't busy, so up to a point. But even that, in the end, you go, actually, I don't think this is going to be entirely solved by something, as it were, outside of myself. It has to, in some sense, come from within. And then I think there are nuances even to that, actually, because I don't think I'm advocating that we all live as monks on our own. I think, you know, we can get philosophically into back to what is the self,
yeah,
that's having this conversation with itself. You know, I don't want to get too far down that sort of pedantic thing. But there's definitely been, for me, a sense of I've been able to contain myself more skillfully in recent years, and that makes a difference.
Yeah, and I think there is a play, I think, between what we can find within ourselves and then just how we benefit from connection and being part of something as well. I think it's like you were saying earlier with something I said, like it's not in neither extreme. I think in my experience anyway, it's sometimes I need people to explore something, and then sometimes I find something within myself, and I'm usually surprised at where it comes from when either a revelation or a shift occurs. Anyway, it's not like it's pre-planned or figured out ahead of time. Just,
I think.
Can you please?
Can I just say one thing? Yeah, I mean, I think that's an extension of the sort of having a richer vocabulary for our feelings. I think it's something about becoming a little bit more sensitive to what exactly it is we want from other people.
Yeah, yeah.
So the experiment that you've been running, Mark, which has been so extraordinary, the conversations where we sit on Zoom together but sit in silence and we don't close our eyes and meditate, we sort of stay available in some way or other to the camera without staring down it. We're with each other. And those are very powerful experiences. And they've gone, I've realized from that. That gives me something that I really need that I haven't quite put my finger on before, that there's that sense of just being there in the same metaphorical room with people, not saying anything, but just choosing to be together and not doing too much as a kind of companionship. And that, you know, I often think that maybe I need some of that. But in the modern world, we think, no, you don't need that. What you need to do is exchange data. Send them, you know, so, you know, the trap I would fall into is I would say I'd write some copy and I'd send it to a friend for feedback. And they, whatever they said, I was annoyed about. And then I realized, this isn't what I want. Maybe I just want some contact. The writing's fine. I'll get back to the writing when it's ready. I'm asking for feedback on this project because that's a grown-up thing to do. But actually all I need is a bit of companionship right now, or a break right now. I can't help thinking, I'm doing this again, that I think we underestimate that we need each other's companionship in a very low-key, gentle way, more than we realize. But we've got ourselves into a rather frantic world of thinking, no, we need 3 for 2.
Yeah.
We need money off and 3 for 2 and faster, more stimulation.
Yeah, and even that we just couldn't sit with each other. We have to go for a meal. And I'm not knocking going for a meal. A meal is a lovely experience. But in general, like that we couldn't just be with each other. We have to do something to justify us congregating in some way, which, yeah, I never really thought about that before. But that's, because that almost puts then we almost have to deliver an outcome from that meeting, as in we both had a great time, didn't we? Then we, you know, even in today, we can also share with everyone else just what a great time we're having. Like,
you send each other one of those surveys.
Yeah, yeah.
Give ourselves marks out of 10.
Johnny, just over the course of this conversation and just, I guess, exploring, you know, not only just what could be possible, what creates that curiosity or that opening to either uncertainty or liminal spaces, or even the desire to explore a perspective or experience life differently from maybe some of the fixed views we have of what life is or what life should be, even if it's making us suffer, to even then exploring our emotional reactions to things, exploring how things shift for us internally in terms of the connections between ourselves, the needs we have from others and the needs we have for ourselves. But I think a lot of the things you've been pointing to is just this, almost this, not fluidity with life, but like an appreciation that it's not, and maybe not what it seems like. So even a flexibility in that sense. Just really curious to get your answer to the question of, and whether it's an answer or just a response as you've been clarifying these things as, to the question of what is a good life for you, Johnny?
Yeah, you see, I should have known that question was coming because I've seen your other podcasts. But I also, and maybe this is part of why the answer to what a good life is, I didn't want to have a rehearsed answer to it. I wanted it to be spontaneous. So I suppose being spontaneous has got to be a very big part of what a good life is, one in which we feel like we have the space to be open about how we feel, more open to experience instead of constantly feeling the need to close it off. Again, I feel slightly tearful saying this because this is not actually rocket science, is it? The mystics have been sharing these kinds of thoughts for a long time. I just didn't understand it before. So more open to experience and more playful, I think. I mean, I do think that, I think throughout my life, you know, and I've had my traumas, as you probably, which I've alluded to, there's always been this other part of me, this very mischievous, you could call it troublemaking, impish, mischievous spirit that is, you know, is quite good at coming up with 1,000 uses for a paperclip, that is willing to say, what else, back to what else is possible here. But there must be more to it than that, in the right way, that to me feels like what a so spontaneous. And I guess what I'm saying is spontaneous and active. That it's not like, it's not just like, it's not just waiting to see what happens. It's understanding that I'm in this game here. What I do has some. I'm in the dance. I'm not on the balcony watching. I'm in the dance.
It's a lovely way to describe it. Almost like co-creation without, like there's a co-creation to it. Like you're a participant in the unfolding as opposed to just an observer of it all unfolding in front of us. Johnny, look, as ever, I've enjoyed this immensely. You've actually left me with a few things I'm pretty sure when I listen back to this as well that have sprouted new lines of inquiry or thought as well for me. So I'm very grateful for that and very grateful for your time for joining us here on the What is a Good Life podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Mark, as well. So I have a very similar experience to you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, Johnny.